Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a collection of sounds from a week of making things. Coming up this time, conductor and researcher Peter Whelan on what we're still learning about Handel in Dublin. And Orit Gat attempts to see Monet in London through the fog. But we begin this time with some skirmishes in the body of the artist Rada Iva Sibila. Sibila is one of three Croatian artists who was in Dublin recently taking over the space at Palace Project for a group show and performance called One Must Imagine Sisyphus Happy. Sibila's contribution was a performance and soundscape installation, channeling her spoken words, captured as she experiences the pain of her arthritis in various positions, as well as sounds collected from her own body, from clattering teeth to heartbeats. Culturefile's Niamh Daly went to record some vital signs.
I think in performative practices, I usually find some kind of a release. I like to think of my body as something else and trying to transform it or make mutations or kind of even maybe mutilate it to some degrees, make it into something else. My name is Rada Iva Sibila. I am from Zagreb. I'm currently studying at Fine Arts Academy in Zagreb. I'm getting my master's. I'm a performer, experimental sound engineer, and a musician, I guess. I'm interested in the topics of altered mental states, fragile mental states, body, and what body is, what it represents in a feminist context and in biological context. I work with my body, so I often find myself in performative practices. Also 3D animation. I can imagine spaces, and the 3D spaces give me the ability of making something that is more unreal in a way, uncanny. So uncanny would also be one of the things I'm interested in. Also sound. When I make songs, it gives me this certain I can breathe when I'm in the bubble. I think nothing else exists and I'm just there in the moment. And with art, I can kind of see it not chronologically, but from all points of view. And that kind of freaks me out sometimes, so it's nice to just have that space of music to run away to, yeah. In my work, I often think about my body as, first of all, female body. So that context is kind of important to me. Also, just my body as like an engine that works for me, in a sense. Where my body is placed in society, how other people see it, how I view it, how other people viewing it makes me view it, and what I can do about it, how can I transcend the idea of freedom of the body, because also from a feminist, I would say, perspective, and also just from like a material, biological perspective, we're kind of slaves to our body. I have my bladder that I need to empty. I need to breathe, I need to eat, my teeth, everything is kind of repulsive to me. I kind of hate the idea of having the body, but also I am amazed by it. So that's also something I work with. When I was 18, I did go through a psychosis clinical, and I was hospitalized for 2 months. So I remember my state of mind then, and that's where I think I can like draw a parallel to the drive I feel in art. But I think like playing with the unconsciousness and dreaming, and also writing, automatical writing, and imagining things. I have this, I guess you can say, practice before I go to sleep. I just imagine things and some sort of visions or motives or colors or shapes just come to me. So yeah, I think that is a way of altered mental states. So the work in this exhibition is a sound piece that is on four speakers. I use the sound of my voice and the sound of my body, so recordings of my teeth, the sound of my heart beating, the sound of my stomach growling, and my hair, twisting my hair and pulling my hair. Yeah, so things that happen or that I hear or become aware of when it's kind of a really stressful situation. So when my heart starts beating, suddenly I'm just aware of it and it's just happening and I know I have to deal with it. So from that sense, I was thinking about myself kind of being one entity, let's say, and my heart being another. So I was working through the relationship of me and my parts of my body. We were not in a good relationship, so I kind of personified parts of my body, and they are not nice. And I mean, I'm also not nice to them, kind of dark entities.
Sometimes I feel as though I'm punishing my insides, my stomach. It snarls, hisses, growls, claws.
What I did with sound is I tried to create this world, I guess, where me and the entities, my monsters, will live.
Its appetite gone. As if it, he has consumed itself and me from the inside out.
It's a world of, I guess, corruption and actually kind of evil. And I think me, in that world, I also accept myself as not a perfect being, right? I also have arthritis, genetic, so what happens is my white blood cells attack my body that is actually working fine. So I was also working from that, as my body is actually not nice to me or to itself or to my organs. So that also is why the world is not very good, I say, but in that world I do accept myself also as a not perfect being and not a heroine or a princess longing for salvation. I accept my flaws and I accept them also. And we do maybe fight, but it works. It works, and the chaos actually makes everything feel okay.
Artist Radha Eva Sabila there, and the reporter was Niamh Daly. Now, we've been revisiting Handel's Dublin in recent times on Culture File with the late historian Jonathan Barden, but another of those who's been working strenuously to uncover the musical scene of 1740s Dublin is Peter Whelan, director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. Whelan and the IBO have just recorded a new version of Handel's Messiah for release next year, and he spoke to us about what a contemporary, historically informed performance of the oratorio might be.
With the Irish Baroque Orchestra and what we've been trying to do, including our recording recently, is trying to reconstruct one point in history, because there have been so many versions of Messiah that you could choose from, and Handel seemed to, you know, reinvent it for the players and musicians he had and the occasions that he had throughout his lifetime. So we're looking at it from a point of view as his first thoughts on the work. Of course, he composed it in London, and then he came to Ireland. And it was affected, the first performance, two performances he did in Dublin were affected by who he found in Dublin and the kinds of musicians and singers that were available to him. Now, a lot of people would say that he had no idea what he was going to find in Dublin, that it was an outpost. A lot of very renowned academics said that. But actually, we know now that that wasn't the case. Dublin was a very sophisticated and particularly musical city at the time. And it's just extraordinary over the even past few years, it's a very live and active conversation about what was happening in Ireland at the time and Handel's take on what was happening in Ireland. And it's a very, as I say, active research field, and we're learning things all of the time. I learned in the last week that he arrived in Howth. I learned that he had a stroke while he was in Dublin. I found out that there were two people written down, two sopranos that he used, one woman called Avolio and another woman called Mrs. McLean, who travelled to Dublin with him. And nobody could ever work out which one was singing the soprano roles for him. Now we know it's just that was the same person. That's also something that I discovered in the past week. And it just goes on and on. It's an ever-changing and actually quite fascinating and live topic trying to recreate any one performance of Messiah. He kept the score for Messiah pretty simple, but when he was in Ireland, he had two subscription series. And we know from that he actually had quite a lot of musicians available to him. And from our research and others' research about music in Ireland in the 18th century, we know that there was, you know, a small professional bunch of musicians, but who were very talented. And Handel would have known about these musicians through one man in particular, a man called Matthew Dubourg, who was his principal violinist, who led for Handel in Dublin. Matthew Dubourg, a fascinating character, who had, seemed to have an Irish mother and a Jewish dancing master father who worked in London. So an interesting character all on his own. But he also worked for Handel in London, and the two knew each other. So Matthew Dubourg probably told Handel exactly what he could expect to find in Dublin. You know, the kind of musicians he could expect, the financial conditions he could expect, how the audience would react to him, which was very favourable. So he knew exactly what he was getting into. Of course, the background for Handel was that he was having a terrible time in London. His health was failing, the audiences were turning against him, his operas were super unpopular, so he really needed a change of scene. And that's exactly what Ireland provided. So it was a happy time for him. We know this from his letters. We know that he came out of Ireland, yeah, a very happy person, with a much fuller purse. He did very well in that respect as well. But also he kind of reinvented himself. He saw that oratorios were now the way forward and that Italian opera was in the past.
So in terms of instrumentation, that has changed over the years as the piece is performed over and over again, because it is like a hugely, is it the most performed piece of music in the canon? I don't know. So I imagine that it's getting accretions as it grows and ages.
I think it is one of the most performed works of classical music, and it's certainly the piece that's earned most money for charities, I think. But The instrumentation is pretty simple. I mean, it is just strings, two trumpets and drums. You can have different size of string orchestra. We know that when Handel was in Dublin, the orchestra would have been about roughly six or seven violins, two violas, two cellos, one bass. And he had quite a lot of trumpets you could choose from, probably two trumpets and timps. And that was probably about it. Although some people add oboes and bassoons to the choir parts, but that happened later, maybe about 1750, he officially put that in the parts. Mozart had a go of orchestrating it, and subsequently other people have had a go as well, just to make it more modern, as it were. So you have these huge versions of Messiah performed like in the Hollywood Bowl in the early part of the 1900s with absolutely enormous orchestrations. Even within Handel's lifetime, at the end of his lifetime, they had massed choirs and orchestras singing the piece. But it's one of those pieces, it's kind of like Bach, that you can perform it on a MIDI sample and it'll still keep a lot of its integrity. You can put it through a lot of machinations and it'll still keep its integrity.
At some level, though, it seems that maybe people thought, you know, things like that Hollywood Bowl performance might be going too far. So you have somebody like Martin Perlman in the 80s saying, OK, now we're going to do some kind of authentic, original kind of sounding Messiah.
Yes, but there were a lot of voices saying that, especially during the Victorian era, these masked voices. Was it Shaw, it was an Irish critic, a writer who talking about how it could benefit from a smaller group of about 24 people would be plenty. This is even before the historically informed resurgence. But it's still a tricky question, because of course you could have an enormous choir and it could still be historically informed. That's the world we're in. We could recreate a performance from the 1950s, from the 1930s. So it's just a matter of choice. Most of the forces used, even in Handel's day, were large. It's just the very earliest versions we know from his Dublin were maybe the most intimate. And somehow I think that's quite a refreshing way to hear the piece. You know, he's really deliberately writing it for a theatre rather than a church or an ecclesiastical setting. It's funny to think as well that I think one of the second performances ever or third of Messiah was in St. Finbar's in Cork, which that was one of the first times it was ever in a church. But when we're looking at, or when I'm looking at the piece, I'm certainly trying to recreate the feeling of the Fishamble Street Theatre and how that would have felt, the immediacy of the text, the immediacy of how the musicians relate to a small but full audience wrapped tightly around the musicians and the performers.
The IBO in general doesn't have a chorus, so where did you go looking, because you're going to need one here?
Yes, we don't have a chorus, but what we decided to do again is to take that inspiration from the first Dublin performances, where Handel had about 12 professional singers at his disposal. He had the gents from the cathedral choirs, and we're going to be pretty specific about how many singers he would have had. In terms of adult singers, it's between 12 and 16. It definitely wouldn't have been more than that. There's always a possibility that he added the boys from the choir on the treble line, but in every document that we see, there's no mention of choristers anywhere. And it seems likely that the female soloists, this is the Mrs. Kibber and Mrs. Avolio or Mrs. McLean, they will have sung in the choruses as well. So in the Dublin version, you have upwards of 7 soloists who are all singing all of the choruses and then stepping out. So that in itself brings a very different feel to the performance. I guess the stereotypical performance you might hear nowadays would have 4 soloists who aren't involved in the chorus, who trot on and off during the show. But actually, the original concept was quite different from that. And during Handel's lifetime, there was very often, I think almost always, more than 4 soloists involved. So in that regard, it might feel a little bit different to audiences.
Who is your Mrs. Kibber? Where did you find her?
Mrs. Kibber is just the most fascinating character. I've so much time for her. The more I hear about her, the more I hear her music, the more fascinated I am. Of course, in Handel's time, she was this amazing actress and singer who was disgraced in London. She was involved in a really lurid sex tabloid scandal with these very vivid pictures all over the press, which you can still see. She had to lie low for a while, and I think she tried to escape to Dublin to test the waters to see if she could be re-ingratiated into public life. But of course, everybody in Dublin knew this story and what had happened. And that was a big draw for people for the first performances. I think Handel really knew. It's a bit like the Rite of Spring. It's a deliberately
trolling, it's called these days,
yes,
isn't it?
A tantalizing first night that would draw people in. And I think he used the drama of that. And she added that extra element of pathos. And the Dublin version has a very special role for her. In each of the 3/3, there's a central lyrical aria for Mrs. Kibber, where she pleads in real time for forgiveness with the audience. You know, he was despised, he shall feed his flock, if God be for us. So it's like real time evaluating that there's this character.
There is some talk about her not actually being that great a singer. I wonder how, like, historically informed it would be to have somebody not really singing tremendously well. Or is that a myth?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. They say, some people say her voice was but a mere thread. I think there's a guy called Charles Burney who said that. And that her knowledge of music was not considerable. But I think that I'm going to call this one and say that I think that was nonsense. There's absolutely no way Handel would have used her. She was brought up by the family of the Arnes, who another big British music dynasty who also travelled to Ireland a lot. So there's no way she didn't know a lot about music. Maybe she wasn't the shiniest singer, but she certainly could sing, or else Handel wouldn't have used her. And he kept using her again and again and again after the initial contact in Dublin. In the version that we recorded, we used Helen Charleston, who's got this wonderful burnished sound, and she brings so much pathos to the role. I couldn't be happier. Sometimes you just, you know, I ended up feeling that Mrs. Kibber was in the room, and I couldn't ask more from a singer than that. She's so thoughtful and brought such beauty and communication to the role. I'm really excited about how people will react to this. I think it's just perfect for the version that we were doing.
Peter Whelan there, and his Irish Baroque Orchestra recording of Handel's Messiah is due for release in 2025, a year which, you'll have spotted, is an alarmingly few days away. A hot and cold art trail finally this time, as our correspondent Orit Gad moves between two blockbusting art shows this winter in London, one of Monet and one of Van Gogh, full of images so familiar you might just imagine they're all used up. These are Orit Gad's voice notes.
I remember art history classes in university. When you would get to Van Gogh, Picasso, Da Vinci, the professor would, with some bravado, click the button on the slide projector, yes, I'm that old, and show the sunflowers, or the artist's bedroom, the Mona Lisa, Monk's The Scream, and there will be a buzz in the class. Will she tell us why this is so famous? What makes it so good? Or maybe the buzz was because we thought we knew better. We knew these paintings are popular, but we studied other Van Goghs and other artists. We knew to love things that aren't loved by everyone. We knew to love things that we have not always known. Years later, I look at 21 paintings I already know by Claude Monet, then 61 paintings, a few of which are new to me, by Vincent Van Gogh. There are two shows dedicated to these two famous artists on view in London at the moment. They both close on the same day in late January. Van Gogh, Poets and Lovers at the National Gallery, and Monet in London, Views of the Thames at the Courtauld Gallery, have both sold out, are extremely busy, more well attended than most exhibitions I've seen in my life. I'm not surprised when I walk into the crowded exhibition halls, but I wonder, can blockbuster shows like these offer something new? If we've seen it all before, what is it all these people are looking for or looking at? Both exhibitions are incredibly small and focused. A single location, basically. Van Gogh is in Arles, Monet visiting London. There's the well-known bedroom, the yellow house where Van Gogh tried to start an artist colony, though only Paul Gauguin joined him. The view from his room in a Provençal hospital. In London, Monet painted the same three landmarks, Waterloo Bridge, Charing Cross Bridge, and the Houses of Parliament. The first two were mainly impressions done from the artist's room at the Savoy Hotel. For the Parliament building, he had to cross the river. Monet came to London on multiple visits in the early 1900s. He was charmed by the foggy city, said that on a clear day it had no beauty. He was so sensitive to the way the light conditions changed with the clouds that sometimes he would abandon a painting after 5 minutes, starting a new impression in its place. When he left London to return to France, all the paintings remained unfinished. He completed dozens of them in a studio far from London, but always planned to send the series back and show it in the city. This is the first time it happened. Van Gogh spent just 2 years in the south of France, but the region's characteristics are some of the most recognizable elements in his paintings. Bright sunshine, lavender flowers, people in traditional Provençal gowns, tall cypresses. These are the painter's last views of the world. From Arles, he would move to a hospital in nearby Saint-Rémy, where his world would shrink to a courtyard, and he would paint the hospital and its grounds until his death, age 37, a year later. The sun, a small orange circle, shining around a bridge, brushstrokes minute and quick, meant to convey the quality of the light, oranges and pinks and blues, a foggy day, to weather its own character. I say this, and you can complete the image in your mind. The light shimmering on the water in tight, quick pink brushstrokes, the bridge disappearing in the mist. You know I'm describing a Monet painting. I don't need to say. I could do the same with Van Gogh, could describe thick dabbles of paint, the circular haze around stars, the yellow of the light. Or I could say one word, sunflowers, and we'd imagine the same thing. These are things we share. The way these paintings, these styles, these ideas repeat, keep coming back. I look back at my teenage self in a dark lecture hall, looking at slides of these canvases, and I no longer want to qualify these works' stature. I know I can't see these paintings as if I've never known anything that looked like them before, the way people did in the 19th century. Of course, that's impossible. But at the National Gallery, just next to the sunflowers, is a painting of wonderful pink flowers, wilting a bit in a vase on a table with a couple of yellow books, including Émile Zola's The Joy of Living from 1884. It's not ironic. Van Gogh is not one for irony. And this is what we're offered. In the midst of struggle, that book, those flowers. And even though I could tell you it's a Van Gogh from miles away, it still fills me with a sense of wonder that the flowers could be so real, but so thick and personal. How, in Van Gogh, the weather is like a character, the light affects its traits. It would take 10 minutes to walk along the Strand from the Courtauld to the National Gallery. If tickets were available, one could see both exhibitions in a single day. I did it over 2 visits, separated by a weekend. Immersed in art history, on my morning runs, the autumn sun in the park felt familiar from paintings. I forgot how I definitely swam in the Thames many times, how I had one of the worst meals of my life in the yellow cafe Van Gogh painted in Arles when he first arrived. The art you already know can make the days seem different. I take the 176 bus from South London to the Courtauld over Waterloo Bridge. It's sunset, and I get off at Savoy Street, just by Monet's hotel. At the Courtauld, I look at the landscape I just crossed. You can look at art like the city you live in. You think you already know it, and then find something else there. What is left to say about things we've already seen? Perhaps nothing. Perhaps it's about coming to them afresh and meeting them again. Perhaps that's the lesson against feeling that things are always the same. The weather, the multiple versions when a painting seems to slip away as the sun does. The lesson of art is the lesson of Monet coming home with over 100 incomplete canvases and sitting down to finish each and every one of them with the knowledge that you can see the same thing over and over again from practically the same angle and see it anew. Even just 5 minutes later. I view the morning with much alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wondered, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly, I saw you standing there. And in foggy London town, the sun was shining everywhere. A foggy day.
Auret got there on some foggy days in London, with Monet at the Courtauld Institute and Van Gogh at the National Gallery. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more looming shapes in the fog next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.